It is 2017. How full is our glass? That glass being human history. The Better Angels of Our Nature is a book addressing the question of whether violence has declined over recorded history. Using over 150 graphs and 700 pages of text, the author, Steven Pinker, tries to make the case that violence has declined. Book reviews by major newspapers indicate that he has made that case. The author makes no prediction about the future of violence. Again, how full is our glass? The last 100 years have provided significant advances in public health, especially water purity and plumbing, vaccinations for infectious diseases, as well as a better access to food and medical care. Advocates for we seniors never let Congress forget about the importance of Social Security. Recently, in the Los Angeles Times, LAPD Chief Charlie Beck apologized for the war on gangs and the war on drugs called Operation Hammer, which he says led inevitably to the 1992 riots. He promised to, quote, never fail Los Angeles again. The positive is a useful term suggesting that progress toward a goal should include a quality often overlooked. That quality is beyond the normative. It's affirmative. In both Europe and America after 1700, political revolutions as well as the development of technology and literacy brought new possibilities. The Protestant Reformation challenged and changed everything in Christianity, including the support of its clerical hierarchies and people's understanding of their relationship to the divine. Some countries in Europe were racked by warfare, famine, or both. Harsh conditions that prompted hundreds of thousands to migrate to British North America. After our political revolution, the American colonies witnessed a massive internal shift of population to the embattled frontiers of the South and West, where ordinary families endured hardscrabble, rootless lives, and the ever-present threat of attack from dispossessed Indian tribes. Such circumstances also thrust women into newly responsible roles for the survival of migrating households, as families were fragmented by movement and death. In this period, a Christian religious movement called the Great Awakening brought a revitalization of religious piety that swept through the American colonies. This movement pulled away from ritual, ceremony, and sacramentalism. Christianity became intensely personal to many by fostering a stronger sense of spiritual conviction and redemption, encouraging introspection and a commitment to a new standard of personal morality. There was a growing sense by some common citizens that the mind and its thoughts held a special power. One simple idea, a book by Mitch Horowitz, describes how pioneers of what could be called a positive thought movement probed the possibilities and capacities of our psyches earlier than many scientists, theologians, or psychologists of the modern industrial age. Reaching back into religion's mystical tradition, this movement attempted to summon women and men to seek a state of awareness in which the barriers between the individual and the whole, the perpetrator and the victim, the giver and the takers, could be seen to fade. An aspect of individualism was being questioned, and some aspect of human agency discovered. Beginning around the mid-1800s, psychical researchers and religious philosophers, mental healers and hypnotists, mesmerists and spiritualists, Unitarians and Transcendentalists, suffragists, black liberationists and Christian socialists, animal rights activists and biblical communists, Freemasons and occultists, artists and free thinkers all found their own way toward cultivating a new power of the mind and thought. After World War II, academic psychology developed a subfield called positive psychology, studying interactions which generate a sense of optimism toward life. The positive thought movement has clearly not solved all of America's problems. Through today, one branch of the movement, called New Thought, continues to be criticized for giving thoughts themselves the power to overcome and prevent both physical illness or large-scale social tragedy. The modern-day movement's reckless use of affirmations drew satire a few years ago from Saturday Night Live's character, Stuart Smalley, as he announced that, "I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me." Mad Magazine's iconic character, Alfred E. Newman, still proclaims, "What? Me worry?" While both satirized affirmations are humorous, the truth behind them was similar. There was trouble in their lives, and they were struggling to deal with it. If I was to guess where Unitarian Universalism stands on the power of thought and the mind, I would say that our foundational seven principles speak to the here and now, the practical. They make reference to dignity, equity, community, and harmony with the rhythms of nature. Where is our search for truth and meaning, the right of conscience, the interdependent web and the sacred circle, mind, and harmony with the rhythms of nature? In other words, where is the long term? I believe it's found in the heart of a spiritual practice which has a healthy regard for non-practical thinking and feeling, which considers the essential good. As our third principle says in part, encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations. Three of our six sources address this issue directly. They are direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder, affirmed in all cultures, which moves us to a renewal of the spirit and an openness to the forces which create and uphold life. Wisdom from the world's religions, which inspires us in our ethical and spiritual life. Spiritual teachings of earth-centered traditions which celebrate the sacred circle of life and instruct us to live in harmony with the rhythms of nature. How do we know what's needed in the long term? Is having a reasonable idea of social progress enough? Is acting on that idea naturally going to include a sensitivity to weaknesses in our results? Can we be, at times, overconfident? Meditation is an excellent method of obtaining clarity, of getting the mind's dust to settle, so to speak. But meditation is only part of a spiritual practice. Without a moral component, long-term renewal will be limited. Traditionally, for anyone brought up in a Christian home, the afterlife, heaven, was the goal. In practice, most of us transferred much of that goal to our time on earth, and renewal was not understood as a priority. Over the last 30 years or so, renewal has become somewhat of a secular or short-term goal. Health, both physical and psychological, have become practical, conscious goals. Time at the gym or meditating have become regular activities of tens of millions of people. Has religion become passé? Is the positive in and the divine out? Attendance is down across Western religions, but secular renewal is not. Spirituality, which I understand as a process of long-term renewal, is still desired by many and available to all. Let the game come to you. In a spiritual practice, we minimize our practical lives so that we consider what is most essentially good. We risk looking at how we're investing our time. This is what the brain does naturally. 24/7, we compare and contrast what we've done and what we're doing according to a standard. While dreaming, we process the day, the week, and beyond with a moral component, asking ourselves, are we handling life? Are we mastering life? Are we becoming better people? Can we think our way to long-term renewal? What is the role of emotion? Do the phrases a good cry or a good laugh have any meaning for us? Is it possible that the authentic discharging of emotion is a necessary part of long-term renewal? In a loss of what is sacred to each of us, how close does involuntary grief and fear come? For over 2,000 years, a purging of the emotions has been considered a process of purification. And science still really doesn't understand why we cry. History points out that many conscientious religious individuals experience emotions that create positive connections among people, which facilitates others to express their values and potential. Four so-called emotions are described as sacred: gratitude, compassion, forgiveness, and humility. All of this could be seen last April on a late-night talk show, Jimmy Kimmel Live. Jimmy Kimmel did his monologue through his tears and was funny. He told us about his son, born a week before with a heart problem, who was given life-saving surgery as soon as the specialist could get there. On screen, Jimmy thanked everyone involved in his son's care and wondered out loud how many children might not be so lucky if their parents couldn't have afforded medical insurance. Jimmy Kimmel was grateful, compassionate, and forgiving. He had been humbled by the possible loss of his child and in turn became creative as he shared his pain through his tears. Jimmy Kimmel explored the mysteries of birth, death, and resurrection with us, and we all got a taste of the divine. Thank you.